Monster Man, special episode, Mind Flayers. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers. And in particular, by patron Cassandra Lockwood, who has asked me to talk about Mind Flayers. If you'd like to be like Cassandra and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I talk about the Deities and Demigods supplement and how to use it in your games. So Cassandra, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy the episode. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about the history, that is the textual history, of the Mind Flayer. It's actually one of the earliest additional D&D monsters, by which I mean that it doesn't appear in the 1974 Dungeons & Dragons box set, but it appears very shortly thereafter. It first appears in the Strategic Review, that's the TSR magazine, essentially a precursor to what would become Dragon magazine, number one in 1975. Subsequently appears in the Monster Manual in 1977, and then it's elaborated on in a Roger Moore article called The Ecology of the Mind Flayer in Dragon magazine number 78. And it's interesting because it is a monster that has been kind of continuously added to and continuously developed throughout the history of D&D. And I think that there are some specific reasons for that, which I'm going to be discussing. So an example of that would be the way in which Mind Flayers, rather than some other D&D monster, are part of the background of the Githyanki and Githzerai when they're introduced in the Fiend Folio. Now, obviously, that comes out in 1981, but chances are that the text, you know, because of that book's long and complicated publication history, that the text was written significantly before that, so sometime in the late 1970s. So throughout the 70s, we're seeing Mind Flayers get more and more detailed and more developed. There seems to be something about them that makes people want to kind of contribute to them in a way that maybe isn't true for some other monsters, either because they're sort of presented as complete or because they're less appealing. Gary Gygax has said that the Mind Flayers were inspired by the cover of a Brian Lumley novel, The Burrowers Beneath. And I assume he's talking about the Daw paperback. I haven't lined up the dates, but I think that that's probably about right. And certainly the illustration seems to fit. The Burrowers Beneath introduces the Chthonians, a race of tentacled sort of pseudo-Lovecraftian monstrosities, and the cover just shows this group of tentacles bursting out of the ground. So I think that, you know, if Gygax took some inspiration from that, it was probably no more than tentacled creatures and they live underground, although it should be said that the Chthonians in the Burrows Beneath are at least somewhat telepathic. Now, The Burrows Beneath is a Titus Crowe novel, and I don't want to go on a whole Titus Crowe diversion because there's something hilarious about Titus Crowe. Brian Lumley seems to have thought that, like, the problem with H.P. Lovecraft is that his protagonists are kind of wussy, but that a real He-Man of occultism and monster fighting was really what the Cthulhu mythos needed, which I think from a mythos purist standpoint, and that's kind of where I tend to fall, obviously that's a ridiculous and terrible idea. But from a pulp adventure horror standpoint, it's probably not too far off the mark. And since that's what we're doing here in Dungeons & Dragons, Titus Crowe might be inspirational. I think, you know, the occasional Titus Crowe story is good for a laugh. I wouldn't try to read more than one in a row. They don't really work like that. Anyway, so, I mean, what's interesting to me about this history is that a lot of the stuff that we think of as the core of the Mind Flayer, the sort of the army of brainwashed creatures, the conspiracy stuff, the elder brains, the being aliens, that doesn't come in the earliest appearance of the creatures, but they're sort of elaborated on piece by piece throughout their early history. There was clearly something about them that suggested these traits to later authors, and something about them that made them seem interesting to elaborate on. You know, we've talked before about what it is that makes a monster interesting to include in a game or interesting to players, you know, why players are compelled by certain monsters. But we haven't really thought about why later writers might go back and kind of pluck. The Mind Flayer is quite a, you know, in the Monster Manual, there's nothing that makes the Mind Flayer really stand out, maybe other than the kind of cartoony illustration. There's nothing where you would look at it and go, this is going to go on to become one of the major features of sort of Dungeons & Dragons, right? Like, when you think about what are the iconic monsters of Dungeons & Dragons, Mind Flayers are going to be among them, along with, like, Beholders and stuff like that. But it's not initially obvious. I think there are five key traits that make the Mind Flayer such an interesting and effective villain, and that make it so appealing to DMs and to game creators. The first is that they have this very interesting pulp sci-fi aesthetic. When you look at how the Mind Flayers are depicted, they look very much like they should be in, like, a Republic serial or a, like a sci-fi TV show or like a Gerry Anderson show, maybe. Because they have, first, they have, in terms of their physical structure, the most televisual of monster forms, which is that they have a humanoid body, but then with some kind of an alien head on top, you know, so that such as could be a mask. So you could see a Mind Flayer in Doctor Who in a way that you'd be less likely to see, like, a Zorn, right? You could see a Mind Flayer on Star Trek, which is not so much the case for, like, a dragon. That's one. The other aspect of their aesthetic is that they are not particularly faux medieval. Like, okay, they wear long robes, but, like, long, high-collared robes, to me, remind me not so much of a medieval wizard, although obviously that's kind of what it's meant to evoke, but of, like, Tom Baker era Time Lords from Doctor Who or, like, Doctor Strange. I guess what I'm saying is that with their sort of pulp science fiction aesthetic, this kind of Ming the Merciless look, they may be the most 70s looking D&D monster. Of course, they are from the 70s. But most D&D monsters, even though they are from the 70s, don't look like they're from the 70s. But if I asked you which day, if I showed you the illustration of the Mind Flayer from the Monster Manual and I said, which era is this creature from? I think you'd have a reasonable chance at saying, oh yeah, it's from the 70s. That kind of like gonzo psychedelia. And they have these other features that are very 70s-y. So for example, they don't do magic. They have ESP, right? And the 70s, of course, is boom time of people being interested in parapsychology and the paranormal, in psychic powers, all that stuff. So that's very in keeping with the 70s-iness of the Mind Flayers, right? Psychedelic squid monsters in kind of like funky robes who don't do magic. They have like psychic mind powers, man. And as they have kind of a sci-fi aesthetic, so too the Mind Flayer addresses a science fictional fear, the fear of the loss of individuality, typically one that you find in horror and in science fiction much more so than in fantasy. Right? So fantasy settings often have as their, or fantasy stories often have as an aspect, like the assertion of individuality. Like they're often set in kind of like humdrum run-of-the-mill societies. You think of like the Shire or wherever, you know, where characters have to kind of break free from the norms and restrictions placed on them by everyday society. But the idea of being like assimilated or being forced to conform, of having your mind controlled, all that kind of like Philip K. Dick stuff, like that's more something that I associate with science fiction, and I think that that's the case with the Mind Flayers as well, who, of course, like they're aliens. And this occurs, interestingly, like both metaphorically and literally. So metaphorically, they eat people's brains, but also literally, they have this like psychic domination that they do to other people. And so we have like both metaphorically and literally, they take away the thing that makes you you. They take away your mind. Next, they have this kind of conspiracy. Now, this is not something that's introduced in the 70s, or at least not in the Monster Manual, but by the time we get to the Roger Moore Ecology the Mind Flayer article, that's in 1983, we have this idea that there are like secretive cities of Mind Flayers deep under the surface of the world, and in fact, that the Mind Flayers come from some extraplanar place, and then they send these like expeditions to prime material planes. It actually says prime material planes, so other places on the prime material plane, I don't know. Planar cosmology is not always my strong suit, but the idea being that these Mind Flayers are like advanced scouts for an alien invasion, which is a very classic conspiracy thing, and again, something that I tend to associate with kind of like the alien conspiracy narratives that are arising, not just in the 70s, but they're certainly around at that time, right? Again, they're very Doctor Who-ish. So this idea that like, oh yes, there's a massive alien invasion fleet, but we don't have that kind of budget, so what there are is three guys in robes and masks. And this is a step outside what most D&D monsters have about them, right? So the original Mind Flayer is certainly presented as something that you just probably run into in a dungeon, but very quickly we move outside that into this idea that there is this vast Mind Flayer conspiracy. Now, there are aspects of the Mind Flayers, again, these are mostly added later, although not all, that I think do give them a sense of alienness. In fact, this sort of calls back to a recent special episode we did in which I talked about how to make alien monsters more alien. And I think the Mind Flayers have got a couple of good parts of this about them. So they have one weakness, which is a pretty common signifier for unnaturalness, which is that they don't like bright light. You know, they come from a lightless void or whatever, and so therefore they can't really like focus or concentrate when they're dealing with the pain that bright light causes them. So it's a good way to mess up their psychic powers and disrupt their hold over somebody. Of course, they're not foolish enough to go into places where there will be bright light. The second is that they have very high magic resistance. They have magic resistance 90%. And what that means is that, like, not only do they have these psionic powers instead of magic, but, you know, they're unmagical in some way, right? Which almost has a connection to the idea that what they are is science fiction monsters inexplicably in a fantasy setting. And in the Ecology article, Moore actually has the character, this Githyanki who's talking about the Mind Flayers, say, you know, they come from an anti-magical, or one theory is that they come from an anti-magical plane. So there's something unmagical about the plane that they come from. So they have psionics, yes, but magic, no. They don't really understand magic, but it doesn't work very well on them. And the conspiracy that they are carrying out, they're carrying out in a way that pretty much everybody hates. They're very universally applicable antagonists because they're tyrants and enslavers. So what they do is that they build this entire society that's just built on subjugation. It was entirely built on slave labor. Moore says that they they dominate all these slaves to build their cities for them, but then they kill them all so that they can never reveal its location. And in fact, they eat brains physically, like not for any type of reason, not because they need to, but as a symbolic expression of their dominance over lesser species. I can consume your individuality, your identity, because that's just fair, because I'm so much better than you are. And everybody hates tyrants, right? Chaotic characters hate them because they don't like being told what to do. Good characters hate them because they do harm. And even lawful evil characters hate them because they're rivals. The two tyrants don't necessarily like each other. So now that we've identified kind of what works and what really stands out in the history of the Mind Flayers, how do we apply them in our games? I think that there is one possibility that maybe is lost now, which is to have the Mind Flayer be kind of like alien and unique. At present, I think because they're such a recognizable part of the D&D quote-unquote canon, this is a little more difficult. You could do this if you're playing with new players, which is start out with a Mind Flayer and then slowly reveal that there is a whole society of Mind Flayers. The other thing that you could do is even start off with the Mind Flayer as like a masked villain. So if you imagine some kind of hooded or helmed evil cult leader, people might not necessarily know that that was a Mind Flayer because it's a humanoid creature, you know, it's just this wearing a robe and an all-concealing mask, but that's sort of what you expect from a supervillain. So first we start off with a mysterious masked figure who is directing the activities of the bad guys, and then from there we move to it being like, oh no, he's not just a villain, but an alien who's come to our plane to try and take it over. Oh, and no, wait, he's not just an alien, but a whole force of aliens, a whole army of them, and not just this advanced landing party, but if they manage to find the blue jewel, then, you know, they'll be able to open the vast dimensional portal that'll bring them from their ruined world through to ours, and then have another prime material plane to pillage and despoil. Because there are later articles that suggest that, like, the Mind Flayers have been to other worlds before and just kind of consumed them. With Mind Flayers, I feel like it's important to emphasize the horror of mind control. And the easiest way to do this is to create an NPC or NPCs, you know, to have friendly NPCs who get taken over by the Mind Flayers. This is a little bit tricky because you want to establish the personality, the characteristics of the NPC, but not necessarily to, like, spend a huge amount of time on them, because I'm not saying it has to be some beloved NPC, you know, that is in every session. You know, it's not necessarily like some PC's mom or something, but it's just like, huh, you know, the bartender was acting different today. Hey, did the priest at the temple seem like they were the same, or were they acting funny? And so then gradually you can see how the Mind Flayer is taking these people you like and taking away the things about them that you like. That is to say, their personality, their thoughts, their ways of speaking. And so you have now got this additional kind of personal level of motivation to go and foil whatever plan. On the one hand, you don't want them to use the Blue Jewel to bring their Mind Flayer tentacly legions to our plane and completely mess it up. But on the other hand, you also have this personal thing, which is that they've taken people that you liked and then dominated and enslaved them, and you need to go and free them. So some people want to go save the world, and that's a great motivation, but you can't save the world every time. Sometimes you just have to save the kindly old priest. And that works too. And in fact, you can use the kindly old priest scenario as a lead into the saving the world scenario. The third thing you can do, and I think this is quite tricky, you know, this works well for some kinds of villain, and that is to distinguish an individual Mind Flayer in some way. The problem is that most of the ways in which you would distinguish a Mind Flayer would tend toward humanizing it, which I don't think you want to do. You want them to be completely alien as much as possible. But if you can do that, you know, you want that sort of sense that, you know, they start off just fighting, you know, Zul'Barath, the Mind Flayer, and then they discover that there's a whole conspiracy of Mind Flayers behind Zul'Barath. And in fact, you could even have that scene where Zul'Barath reports to the Elder Brain and is like, oh, they've escaped me once again, but I promise you, it won't happen again. Soon I will have captured the meddling adventurers and taken the Blue Jewel. And the Elder Brain's like, Zul'Barath, you have failed us for the last time. I think you can't really be a supervillain unless at some point you tell somebody that they have failed you for the last time. Of course, since the Mind Flayer is a conspiracy monster, then you have to develop a conspiracy goal for them. It sort of doesn't really matter what this is, as long as it's something that the players can avert. I mentioned the idea that you want to prevent the Mind Flayers from, like, getting the Blue Jewel in order to, you know, bring their Mind Flayer legions to our world. This is actually maybe not the best kind of conspiracy goal, because what you don't want when designing a monster's conspiracy is something that, if the players do their jobs, nothing happens. So if the Mind Flayers do get the Blue Jewel, and the players have to battle them upon some ancient temple in the Underdark, that's interesting. If the Mind Flayers just don't get the Blue Jewel, and they didn't have it to begin with, then that's kind of dull, because you wind up with, I don't know, a situation where the PCs are essentially attempting to maintain the status quo, and they are essentially defensive in their choices, which means they're probably not going to do anything other than react to the decisions that the Mind Flayers make. Whereas you want to put a situation that they don't like out into the world, and then see what they do in order to change that situation. Maybe they embark on an assassination campaign in order to attempt to, like, get rid of the Mind Flayer stooges who are running the government of the kingdom where they're tunneling for the Blue Jewel. Maybe they try to find another way into the tunnel complex so that they can steal the Blue Jewel before the Mind Flayers get it. Maybe they go and, you know, summon up the ghost of the ancient mage who enchanted the Blue Jewel to see if there's any way to break the curse. Maybe they take Void Ship and go to the other dimension that the Mind Flayers come from in order to destroy their Mind Flayer Elder Brain before, etc., 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 right? So you want a conspiracy goal that is interferable with in a number of different interesting ways. Because otherwise what you're going to wind up with is a threat so apocalyptic that it's impossible for the PCs in character to overlook it, and yet that eventually becomes repetitive if what you're always doing is, you know, going down into the Underdark to take out some kind of secret Mind Flayer base. This is a big problem with end-of-the-world type plots in general, right? It's because if you threaten the world and the safety of the world, then it makes sense, because it's a challenge that is very easy to get the players motivated with, right? Sometimes you wind up with something where it's not obvious why the players would get involved. Like, oh, a mysterious ghost ship has been seen near this village. Well, that's cool. Huh. These curious pieces of local folklore, they're probably not going to go check it out. Or, I don't know about probably not, but they certainly, it wouldn't be unreasonable for them not to. If the world is being threatened, then obviously everyone should be doing everything they can to put a stop to that. But you can't do it more than once, and it also sort of signals to the players that you're not completely serious. Like, probably in your campaign, the world is not going to get overrun by Mind Flayer hordes. And if the PCs are low level, you also wind up with this situation where, like, they're not the best people to deal with this threat, right? Like, the sensible thing for them to do is to report it to the proper authorities. It's one of the good things about the Mind Flayers, because corrupting the proper authorities in any environment, it'd be the first thing that the Mind Flayers do. It's also one of the nice things about Mind Flayers is that they scale up as antagonists. So if you're fighting lower level opponents, then you're making your way through all of the, like, bad guys that the Mind Flayer has brainwashed, indeed maybe even good guys, so you can get the twist on there, which is like, oh well, these things are trying to kill us, but we actually don't want to hurt them because they are good people who have merely been subverted by the Mind Flayer. That's really cool. But then later on, after you get more powerful, you could find yourself, fighting the Mind Flayers themselves deep in their subterranean lair, and even going toe-to-toe with the mighty Elder Brain. I mean, it doesn't have any toes, but you know what I mean. That brings me to my final point about how to use Mind Flayers in a campaign, which is that you want to develop the armies of, like, brainwashed people. And you do this, I think, much like the same way that I described developing the Conspiramid in my episode about recurring villains. You know, as your kind of underdark setting continues to develop across the history of D&D, you start to get these lists of other types of creatures that dwell underground and that are, like, particularly common for the Mind Flayers to take over and manipulate. In the Ecology of the Mind Flayer article, Moore uses Grimlocks and Were-Rats as examples, right? So there are tribes of Grimlocks that just, like, live underground. Grimlocks are basically Morlocks from the Time Machine, and so that makes perfect sense. You know, they're the kind of people where there'd be a bunch of them living in some, you know, dank cave, ambushing passersby and whatever, and the Mind Flayers could just come along and brainwash them en masse because, you know, Grimlocks with the best will in the world, they're tough, but they're not very bright. Similarly, Were-Rats live in lots of, like, subterranean tunnels and sewers and things like that. It would be easy for the Mind Flayers to take control, particularly if you have any society that's kind of, like, hierarchical. It would be easy for the Mind Flayers to just dominate the chief or the shaman or whatever and have that person go, oh yeah, you know, the spirits told me that we need to cooperate with these Mind Flayers. And now you don't even have to brainwash a gazillion Were-Rats individually. You just, you know, brainwash their matriarchs, and they go down into the Underdark to serve you. Also, you got Githzerai, who, unlike the Githyanki, will cooperate with the Mind Flayers. And it also talks about them having, like, beholders as allies. But those operate on a more nearly equal footing, so, like, you might have this kind of Destro situation where, because they need somebody that understands magic, or for whatever reason, the Mind Flayers have brought in this kind of specialist who is not a Mind Flayer, just another Underdark weirdo who's trying to advance their own personal agenda. And that can be fun because, you know, a bit like with Destro, one of the things that's always happening is that Destro is always getting subverted. And because his agenda is not quite the same as the agenda of the rest of his team, it's easier for the good guys to try and get him to do what they want by appealing to his self-interest or his sense of honor or the fact that, like, the baddies are trying to destroy the world and that's where he lives. But of course, this is just, like, assuming some kind of normal Underdark, whatever that means. In any given circumstance, you can say that the Mind Flayers have taken over, you know, some location. So, like, that small village where the locals all look at outsiders strangely, is it because they're a bunch of xenophobic rubes, or is it because the Mind Flayers have, like, dominated them and are making sure that they don't give away their presence? Any other kind of isolated population that, particularly isolated populations that don't have, like, a lot of contact with the outside world or that don't have a lot of recourse. So a prison would be a good example, or maybe, like, the garrison of a fortress, sailors on a ship, anything like that would be particularly vulnerable to the Mind Flayer because there's not regular contact with outsiders, so nobody's going to notice that they're all acting funny. And it's ideal for Dungeons & Dragons because, of course, one thing that player characters very consistently do is go to the kinds of places that normal people don't go. They're very likely to be, like, the only visitors that this remote monastery has had in a year. And when they get there, they're like, is this really what monks are supposed to be doing? They're all just kind of, you know, mining as if they were searching for the Blue Jewel. You know, anyway, wherever it is, you can have that sense of a place that is normal but that has suddenly gone weird. And that's a very good horror image, right? Like, that violation of normality is something that indicates that something's very wrong. And it makes sense that the Mind Flayers might not necessarily cover it up because it's not like they really know anything about human behavior. So they don't understand that what they're doing sticks out to outsiders. But they are aware that they don't understand that, if you see what I mean, so they try to keep their populations away from outsiders. So anyway, that's an overview of the history of the Mind Flayer, what I think are the kind of salient points of the Mind Flayer, and the ways in which I think a Mind Flayer, like, the role that it fulfills in a campaign. Now, obviously, there's a lot more, because these are our creatures that get really elaborated and detailed. There's lots of stuff about the Mind Flayer. I mean, I barely scratched the surface. You know, so in second edition, they get this book, The Illithiad, that talks about, again, they're from the Far Realm, and they're, or like in 3.5, they're a bit like the Shida in Seven Soldiers of Victory, which is a comic series that I really like. Basically, they're these people who live at the end of time and, you know, facing death with the eventual heat death of the universe, they have gone back in time to try and take over the universe in their own past. There are lots of different versions of the origin of these creatures. And I actually think that that really works because there's all this ambiguity about the origin of the Mind Flayers. You know, you can have it be whatever you want it to be. I mean, you can almost have it be whatever you want it to be. But it seems fitting to these alien creatures that there's no consensus about who they are. But there are, in all of these different origin myths, there are these shared images of, like, decadence and corruption, of once powerful civilizations that collapsed, of hubris and self-interest, a willingness to sacrifice whole worlds just to meet the material needs of a particular civilization. So, you know, the Mind Flayers are kind of this, like, dark mirror to humanity's behavior. You know, they enslave and dominate and tyrannize, and, you know, maybe a lot of human civilizations do the same thing, right? You know, like a lot of good villains, they have traits that we can sometimes recognize in our own societies. Okay, that was a digression, basically because I checked my notes about origins of the Illithids and found I had one or two more things to say about them. But anyway. So anyway, like I was saying, that's the overview of the Illithids. I hope that you enjoyed the episode, Cassandra. And again, if you'd like to be like Cassandra, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we'll be returning to the S chapter of Monster Manual 2. In fact, we're gonna be completing it as we look at the Swan May, and the Swordfish, all here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.